This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The immigrant's immigrant, the expatriate's expatriate, the enduring victim of every practical joke the late 20th century had to offer, and an unlikely hero for our times. That's how Gary Steingart describes the protagonist of his new novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's based on Steingart's experiences as a Jewish Soviet emigre who spent the first 7 years of his life in Leningrad, then moved to New York with his family in 1979. The novel focuses on the absurdities of life in the Soviet Union, the U.S., and post-communist Eastern Europe. The novel opens in 1993 when the main character, Vladimir Gershkin, is 25, frustrated with his job at the Emma Lazarus Immigrant Absorption Society, and bored with his girlfriend and her torn black shirts and gothic bracelets and crucifixes. Never having fit into the U.S., after the Cold War, Gershkin leaves for Prava, a fictional city in Eastern Europe, which is attracting lots of young Americans. Let's start with a reading.
In this part of the book, Vladimir Gershkin, who is a kind of malfunctioning immigrant, ends up in Eastern Europe, and he has developed a sort of cultural Ponzi scheme with which he wishes to defraud and get money from the many Americans who have settled in this very hip city in Eastern Europe called Prava. And at this point, he's selling this cultural Ponzi scheme to the Russian mafia, whom he has befriended and who he's working for, and which the mafia is led by a gentleman named the Groundhog. So now Vladimir is speaking. How do we get the Americans to invest in the first place? Here is the answer: self-esteem. Most of these young men and women are trying desperately to justify their presence in Prava and the interruption of their education, their careers, and so on. We make them feel like they're taking part in the resurgence of Eastern Europe. There's an American saying spoken by a famous black man: if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. This saying has deep resonance in the American psyche, particularly among the liberal kind of American the city attracts. Now we've got them not only becoming part of the solution, but making money in the process. Or so they'll think. "Wait 1 minute," the groundhog said. "We don't know any Americans." "That, friends," Vladimir said, "is why I'm here with you today. I propose that I single-handedly infiltrate the American community in Prava. Despite my fluent Russian and my tolerance of drink, I can easily double as a first-rate American. My credentials are impeccable. I have attended one of the premier liberal-minded colleges in the States and have a profound appreciation for the dress, manners, and outlook of the disaffected young American set. I have lived many years in New York, the capital of the disaffected movement, have had many angry, disenfranchised friends of the artistic persuasion, and have just completed a romantic liaison with a woman who in both looks and temperament personifies the vanguard of this unique social group. Gentlemen, with no intention of conceit, I assure you, I am the best there is, and that's that."
Gary Steingart, would you describe the Ponzi scheme that your character comes up with?
Well, it's a very complicated Ponzi scheme. Basically, there's these Americans running around who have no business being in Eastern Europe, but who have come, the way many Americans came to Prague in the early 1990s, to make a go of it, to try, at one point I call it the five-year plan of alcoholic self-discovery. So Vladimir, being both... being a Russian, but one who has lived in America for a lot of his... large portion of his life, wishes to defraud them through launching, for instance, a literary magazine called Cagliostro, which is the name of a Sicilian charlatan, I believe, in the Middle Ages, and through other kinds of literary and cultural conceits. It's a sort of a cultural Ponzi scheme, which is a term that came to me after, in the course of one's life in New York, one goes to many, one has to support one's friends, and one goes to these bizarre performances and, you know, mime and acrobatic acts, and then your friends go to your performances. So it's sort of this pyramid scheme where everybody supports everybody, but in the end, the amount of actual raw talent is quite small.
Now, this Ponzi scheme is designed to play on Americans' shaky self-esteem. Why did you focus on self-esteem?
Well, because despite being the citizens of a global superpower, many Americans feel themselves culturally inferior to Europe. And I think this may have to do with the fact that America is at the helm of popular culture throughout the world, which is often seen by others as being, offensive, for instance. I was... last year I traveled all over the former Soviet Union, and here is a culture sort of in the making, because the whole socialist template has fallen to the wayside, and what has come in its place is American popular culture. For instance, I was in Georgia, and there was a gentleman with an accordion who sings Britney Spears songs. He has a very kind of old-fashioned voice, and he sings, "Oops, I did it once more, bum, 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 bum," to an accordion beat. It's really funny and kind of sweet, but at the same time a little scary. And I think that that's what many Americans are afraid of, that they are doing this to the planet at large. Understandable.
About being an immigrant, you've said, getting out of Russia was certainly no panacea. We brought the Soviet Union with us wherever we went. What do you mean?
Well, it's inescapable. I mean, let's look at it this way. Jews and Russians are some of the most anxiety-ridden, oppressed, and maligned people in the past two centuries. And when you put them together, Jewish and Russian Jews, it's the making of a mental health crisis. we've been through so much in the past century, and there's no way that you can simply move, you get off the plane at Kennedy Airport, and all of a sudden you are a different person, a person free of these, the madness and fears of these Eastern countries, and all of a sudden you become a happy American. It just doesn't work that way. And I think a lot of people miss that, because even if you're driving your Volvo and you have your Oberlin T-shirt on, you certainly are not the same as a native-born person who has these accoutrements. So it's... there's no way one can shake off history. History follows us wherever we go, I think. And if I ever breed, if I ever have children, I would wonder even if they would have, through having me as a father, whether they would have some of the echoes of this terrible, terrible background from which we come from.
Your family left the Soviet Union when Brezhnev allowed Jewish families to emigrate. Did you practice Judaism in the Soviet Union, and did that change when you moved to the States?
I didn't practice Judaism. I practiced socialism in the Soviet Union.
Right.
As a small child, I was in love with the Communist Party, with the Red Army especially, and Lenin. I can still remember songs. Lenin всегда живой, Lenin всегда с тобой. It means, Lenin, he is always alive. Lenin, he is always with you. And as a child, I was very sick, a typical, Proustian kind of sickness, sick child syndrome. And I would listen to these songs and read these books, and I would feel as if Lenin was almost my big buddy, And I would open the window, and there his bald head would be staring back at me. There was one of the biggest statues of Lenin was right outside where we lived. So I was in love with the Soviet Union. And then we came to the first stop for Soviet Jews was, it was Vienna and then Rome. And in Rome, I was 7 years old, and my father told me that, it was all lies. None of this was real. And I remember it was the first act, the first instance of heartbreak in my life. I couldn't believe it. I used to play with these clothespins that I imagined were Aeroflot planes. Tupolev is the name of the make. And then I remember switching to Boeing and the Concorde, and that was sort of my first change of heart. And then when we got to America, I was sent to Hebrew school, and we gave Judaism a go. And it was terrifying. The kids would, this was the war in Afghanistan, it was just starting up, and Russians were highly unpopular. Remember the movie The Day After and everything like this. So we were the enemy, and the kids would taunt me and make fun of me mercilessly, and I also had this very thick bear coat, and they would call me the stinky Russian bear, much as they do Vladimir Gershkin, the protagonist in the novel. So, so I tried Judaism as much as I could, but that didn't really pan out. So I ended up in Stuyvesant High School, which is one of the math and science high schools, and it's sort of a holding pen for nerds in New York. And there, at this point, I was giving capitalism a go. With all my heart, I wanted to be a capitalist. We had watched Dallas religiously, my mother and I, speaking of religion. JR was a god of sorts. So I tried that for a long time. I really wanted to make money. And I remember in sophomore year, this is so embarrassing to say, I worked for the George Bush campaign. I was a volunteer. And I sat with all these women in these huge fur coats, and me, and a small Russian immigrant, sitting there making cold calls, getting people to vote for Bush. But that wasn't panning out either. So Zelig-like, I decided to take on, this time, a fourth identity. After a loyal Soviet citizen, Jew, capitalist, at this point I decided to become a hippie liberal. And this led me straight to Oberlin College. And at Oberlin, I was very much welcomed by I was a political science major, and I remember there was a visiting professor who would translate Brezhnev's works into Yiddish. You know, this was the sort of thing that went on there. And there, the comrades welcomed me with open arms, too. I wrote a wonderful thesis called Back in the USSR, where it was almost apologizing for Lenin's, the way he had treated, the way he had brought the various nationalities into the fold of the Soviet Union. So basically, after all these different manifestations, the real question was sort of, who am I? You know, who is this Gary Steingart? Which one of these, you know, to put it into a Queen's accent? And I didn't know. And it was about this time that I began writing the Russian Debutante's Handbook. And my alter ego, Vladimir Gershkin, this is when I decided to use him almost as a vehicle for exploring this question.
My guest is Gary Steingart, author of the new novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gary Steingart. He's the author of the new comic novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's based on his experiences as a Russian emigre. He was born in Leningrad and immigrated to New York with his family at the age of 7. Let me get back to your childhood. When Lenin was your hero and you sang songs about him and...
And wrote about him,
and
too.
Wrote about him. I mean, this is just what they wanted, isn't it? To get, like, young, smart minds like yours and convince them that Lenin was an idol, a hero, somebody to be sung about and written about and and idolized in every way.
Yeah, in some ways, the Soviet Union made children of us all. You know, I think no matter what your age is, the idea was sort of to put you in this childhood state of mind and to worship a father figure or father figures, the Politburo, if you will, which never really worked except under Stalin when there was really no choice. But yes, this is exactly the sort of thing that they wanted. And it's not like there was much of an alternative. You know, there wasn't Michael Jordan and the way you would worship in the United States. They had a monopoly on thoughts. And for a young child, I mean, I don't know how long this would have continued. I wanted to join the Red Pioneers, but we emigrated before that was possible. The Red Pioneers is the communist youth group for children.
Right. Now you've been exposed to, like, hero worship as Lenin as a child in the Soviet Union. Then you came to the States during the Cold War years when in many political circles, Lenin and anything communist was reviled and was a subject of hatred and fear. Then you went to college where there was a lot of serious intellectual pursuit of the history of socialism. So having gone through all of these different points of view about socialism and communism, did you find it very confusing, or did you kind of emerge from that with a point of view of your own?
Well, I think the 29 years that I have lived on this earth have been sort of a grand tour of the failure of these various systems to satisfy their populations. Obviously, America, even under the free market system, does a lot better than socialism certainly ever did under Russia. But one can't turn oneself, one can't simply embrace that as well. One has to be critical. So I think, you know, from Lenin worship to Reagan worship in the space of 5 years, that's quite a jump. So I think I've really seen it all. And my life has been full of these strange juxtapositions. I remember my parents came to visit me in Oberlin College. You know, and these are people who have a slightly jaundiced view of socialism. And they were sort of walking through Oberlin. And there were all these signs, the Democratic Socialists of America welcome you to their socialist powwow. I remember at one point my father was walking through the central square in Oberlin. It's the strangest juxtaposition. I'll never forget it. He's walking across the square, and somebody has drawn a giant vagina on the square. And it says beneath it, "Mom, Dad, you capitalist pigs, here I have tasted my lesbian lover's vagina, and may you capitalist pigs go to hell." And my father is sort of sleepwalking right past it, not saying a thing. Oh, he's talking to the tour guide about, you know, "Please tell me about the rebate for Macintosh laptop computer for incoming freshman student." And meanwhile, he's standing, and I'm thinking, "Dad, you know, get off the vagina. You're standing on this giant genital." And that's when it struck me that the story of my life is so inexplicable. All these endless juxtapositions, you know, from the red flag to a meter-high vagina. It was time to get cracking on the book. And at Oberlin is where I started to do so.
Now, how did working on the book help you figure out your life?
Well, in the end, only analysis can really help in this endeavor. Going through Gershkin became a good friend of mine. Gershkin is the protagonist. Vladimir Gershkin became a very good friend of mine. And in fact, one of the reasons I sat on this book for 7 years, you know, I didn't send it out, I didn't think it would go anywhere, is because it was hard to let him go. He was like a girlfriend you don't want to break up with, even though the time has come. He was an alter ego. And also, I could put him through things I would never put myself through, although in some ways my experience echoes his. Sometimes it's almost 100% the symmetry. But I could look at him, I could look at the way he reacted to the people around him, and I could draw lessons about my own life. And I could try to change my own life, ultimately, which is what I did. The creation of Steingart as a viable persona began, I think, when I started seeing an analyst. And this is when I began to realize that one of the major problems we've had in the Soviet Union was the lack of mental health treatment. You know, in Russia, you saw a psychiatrist, you were sent to a psychiatric hospital for writing something like the Russian Debutante's Handbook. But mental health care, per se, did not really exist. The vodka bottle was what you turned to for solace. And then I was working for this wonderful agency called the Educational Alliance. It's a settlement house. And they had this program, I don't know if they still have it, called Project Help. And it was a substance abuse treatment for Russian immigrants, but it also had this psychological component. And in interacting with the staff and patients of this program, I started to realize exactly what we had in our hands. And that's when I began to think, you know what we really need? Instead of all these IMF and World Bank programs in the former Soviet Union, we need to send a plane load of nice New York social workers into Russia in the former Soviet republics. And this would be the best use of World Bank money. Because without forget the infrastructure and the banking system for a while, we have to start at ground zero, in a sense. And that is to work in terms of psychology with the people who have been left behind.
So it's been helpful to you to undergo psychoanalysis?
Oh, yes, it's very helpful.
Did you grow up completely without that concept in the Soviet Union?
Of course, of course. Again, there were psychiatric hospitals, but this was
that was
a
punishment.
State weapon.
Yeah,
it
right.
was punishment. Oh, yes. Little did I know that it could be such a blessing. Only in Oberlin did I realize that everybody had an analyst in Oberlin. And, you know, people would give me nice recommendations. And eventually I found a wonderful analyst in New York.
There's a part in your novel where Vladimir, the main character, wonders if the fall of the Berlin Wall has made him somehow more timely in the way that people regard him in the United States. Did you go through that, too, that's thinking somehow like being a Russian-American was almost more fashionable at about that time?
Well, one of my favorite lines of Vladimir Gershkin, he says, you know, it is better to be patronized than to be ignored. Yes, I did discover that being a small furry immigrant had its cachet, and that I could parlay that. In Oberlin, it was wonderful, because I did feel so ignored for a large part of my life. I didn't fit into any social structure that I can imagine. But all of a sudden, being disenfranchised, as I said during the reading, being disenfranchised was a positive thing in Oberlin. And being an immigrant was a positive thing, too, and I could work with it. So there was that did happen to me. And in the end, you don't feel any better simply because people are interested in you because you don't fit in. This is not what one wishes to achieve, of course. But it was an interesting, anthropologically speaking, it was an interesting experience, and it was something that definitely informed my work.
My guest is Gary Steingart, author of the new novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Gary Steingart, is the author of the new comic novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's based on his experiences as a Russian emigre. He was born in Leningrad and immigrated to New York with his family in 1979 at the age of 7. You've lived in the United States since the age of 7. In what ways do you still feel very Russian?
You know, people ask me, where do you feel better, when you're in Russia or when you're in America? Of course, the answer is in America. Russia is such a depressing country and will be in the foreseeable future. Sometimes I feel that I feel best when I'm on an airplane between continents and I'm surrounded by foreign nationals, and this almost feels natural to me, this constant state of movement, of migration. I don't want to bring up the stereotype of the wandering Jew. I hope I can live beyond that. But on the other hand, it does happen to some extent. In this country, I have never fully assimilated into this country. I can speak the language fairly well. But especially, you know, I used to have a girlfriend from North Carolina, and I would go visit North Carolina. And, of course, I went to college in Ohio. And people, you know, as soon as I opened my mouth, there would be this amazing gap. It seemed that our experiences were so different that I even tried to adopt a Southern twang for a while. I said things like, shoo, doggy, you know. but it didn't work. Nobody believed me. Only in New York, when I touch down in New York on an airplane, do I feel like I'm on solid ground. Because here, everybody's from somewhere else, and it really doesn't matter where you're from. So New York feels like home to me to some extent.
Are there any
more so than the country?
Are there any souvenirs that you've kept from your Soviet childhood?
My walls are festooned with these giant posters. I actually got them after I came, but there are these giant posters, and one is of this. It was called the All-Voluntary Union of the Army, Air Force, and Fleet. It wasn't very voluntary, of course, but it was the scheme to get children to give up their lunch money to the the Air Force. And it was this huge poster with a Yuri Gagarin-type fella, and he's holding on to his space helmet in this almost oil-like gesture. And it says in big letters, big Cyrillic letters, it says, "Learn to defend the motherland." So I wake up every day, and before I get to work, I see Yuri Gagarin, and I feel something's been lost, something's been gained, and I get to work. And some other hilarious propaganda posters. One is, this would be kitsch, I think, anywhere else, but there's this black fist holding up an AK-47, and it says, "The battle continues, Angola will win." And it's a... it's a poster for the Angolan communist government, and you see the Angola, the communist star, and their symbol, which is, I think, the machete. I mean, what's scary about all this, you know, I idolized Lenin. Lenin was a mass murderer. I mean, the myth of the benevolent Lenin has been thrown onto the ash heap of history. I mean, what kind of a childhood are we talking about when your older buddy is a mass murderer? So it really gives you something to think about. If not right about.
You not only left the world that you grew up in, but that world doesn't exist anymore. The Soviet Union doesn't exist. Your city of Leningrad is now St. Petersburg again. You've been back there. How does it look different and feel different than it did when you were a child?
It looks awful. Moscow has become sort of a more westernized city, but Leningrad, or St. Petersburg, if you will, is still falling apart at the seams. All the money is parked in Moscow. So all these things that... the trams sort of ran on time back then, and all the infrastructure has frayed, and there are certain streets, the main street, Nevsky Prospekt, looks very Western, is filled with Benetton stores and whatnot. But for the most part, it looks decrepit, and the people look like they've been through a war. You know, often it feels that the Cold War did have a winner and a loser, and we lost the Cold War. The Russian people lost the Cold War, and they look like it. You ride around and you see some grandma standing on the sidewalk and selling a sock. One sock, not two, mind you, one sock. And this is not how we grew up. It was a poor country by Western standards, but there was something like a middle class. And you knew that if you wanted health care and an education at some level, you could expect that. Jews faced anti-Semitism, and there were other barriers. But for the most part, you knew you weren't going to, that the world wasn't going to fall away beneath your feet, which it has for the 250 million people or even more that live in the former Soviet Union. The mortality rate is through the roof. Russia will have a population of 140 million, I think, in a year or so. And I think in the next century, it may fall to 100 million. The average life expectancy of the Russian male is 55 years. So it's a terrifying place. And it wasn't exactly so when I left it. It was a place that lived... that was based on lies, built on lies. But in terms of the way people lived... most people expected a brighter future than they do at the present.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Gary Steingart's new novel is called The Russian Debutante's Handbook.